You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, May 14th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Nicole Aschoff, lecturer in sociology at Boston University, editor at the Jacobin Magazine, author of The New Profits of Capital. Also on the program today, a deal struck between corporatist Democrats and the White House, which should pave the way for a vote, and probably an affirmative vote, on fast track for the president in the Senate. But the House still looks like it may be a problem for those who are in favor of these horrible so-called trade deals. Also on the program today, the House votes on a watered-down version of NSA reform. Members of the National Transportation Safety Board come out and say this crash, this Amtrak crash, could have been prevented with more funding. And Russ Feingold is back, ladies and gentlemen. The former senator from Wisconsin announces he will be the future senator from Wisconsin. Also, Martin O'Malley set to enter the 2016 presidential race. The Scott Walker special prosecutor says still could be a case against him. Jeb Bush, very rusty on the campaign trail, dealing with the fact that his name is Bush. And a huge beehive die-off. But don't worry, the spokesman from the company that probably has a significant amount of blame says it's not a problem.
Don't worry about it. It's all good.
Yeah, it's okay. Don't worry about it, folks. Yeah, you got to change your microphone, buddy. Because I can actually hear you before you press the button. It's so funny trying to watch him figure it out.
A little sneaky.
All right, folks. Yeah, we got a lot of news today. I don't know if we'll get to all of it, but we certainly will catch up on some of that with Cliff tomorrow. The beehive thing, you know, when this show first launched, I was still sort of very country. This version of the Majority Report, and I believe, if I'm not mistaken, we had Dennis Van Engelsdorp on the program, and I think he was like the chief beekeeper for the state of Pennsylvania. I'm not sure about that. Now apparently he's at the University of Maryland. Maybe he was the chief beekeeper of Maryland. I believe we had him on the program. But he co-authored a report that since April 2014, beekeepers lost almost 45% of their bee colonies. It's the second highest loss rate in 9 years. It's not quite as dire as it sounds because after a colony dies, beekeepers then split their surviving colonies, start new ones, and the numbers go back up again. But the rate of die-off is pretty disturbing. And it's happening during the summer, which is generally not when this happens. It usually happens during the winter. Van Engelsdorp said, seeing a massive colony loss in the summer is like seeing a higher rate of flu deaths in the summer than the winter. You just don't expect colonies to die at that rate in the summer. And then this is the, this is unbelievable. Now, they have found that, I think it's necrotoids or something, that that are causing a lot of this bee colony die-off. Maybe I'm mispronouncing that word, but they're part of these pesticides produced primarily by bear. Just coincidentally, Dick Rogers, the chief beekeeper for pesticide maker Bayer, guess they have their own, well, we've got to test out the effectiveness of our pesticides on killing the bees, said the loss figure is not unusual at all. And he said the survey shows an end result of more colonies now than before. 2.7 million hives in 2015, up from 2.6. But of course, as Van Engelsdorp said, that doesn't mean that the health is improving or stable. After they lose the colonies, beekeepers are splitting their surviving hives to recover their losses, pushing the bees to their limits. So, I don't know. If you see a honeybee, a complete Dick Rogers move, isn't it, to say that it's no big deal? All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nicole Astroff. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Nicole Astroff. She is a lecturer in sociology at BU, editor at the Jacobin Magazine, and author of The New Profits of Capital. Welcome to the program, Nicole.
Hey, Sam. How's it going?
It's going well. I really enjoyed your book, and it is sort of we stumbled into a theme this week about neoliberalism. Of sorts, and yours is a slightly different take in terms of what capitalism, I guess, needs to maintain itself, particularly in an era where it is in crisis. Talk about the necessity of, or I guess, why profits in the title. I mean, what is the necessity of story and profits to capitalism?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I teach in sociology, and actually sociology is really applicable here, and I'm drawing on the idea. Originally it comes from Max Weber, who's sort of one of the most famous sociologists. But more recently, Luke Volkansky and Eva Chapilla were asking, you know, how is it that capitalism can manage to evolve through these very deep periodic crises? Particularly, they were thinking about, you know, the late 60s and the student movement in France in particular. And one of the things that they come away with is this idea that capital and this kind of for-profit structure of society, there's nothing in it itself that can generate kind of a trust and a belief in the system. It has to draw on cultural ideas that exist outside of this kind of for-profit architecture. And what it does is periodically, as it's going through these crises, it looks for voices that are both supportive and also really critical of capital. And they talk about that in relation to management practices. So when we look at things like the emergence of flexible, work arrangements and project work and contingent work and all of this, a lot of this has to do with changes in management to deal with some of the crises that we saw in the 70s. What I'm doing in my book is actually saying, well, let's actually think about that at an even broader kind of society level and think about how capitalism evolves through these deep crises. And as you said, right now we're in this moment where a lot of people are questioning whether the kind of way that society is organized can really meet their needs for justice or security, or even just sort of achieving their dreams in life. And it's interesting that some of the most critical voices that we hear regarding the system as it is now are from these sort of super elites. So I kind of think about people like the Gates and Oprah Winfrey and how the stories that they're kind of telling, while they're critical of certain aspects of society as it is, actually enable the kind of for-profit structure to evolve and persist over time. So that's kind of what I try to do in the book.
And so broadly speaking, I mean, the idea is that they come in the guise of reformers, but in some ways they're not really reforming what is the genuine problem.
Yeah. So, I mean, they are definitely genuine in their desire to fix some of these problems in society. And that's why I actually talk about them, because there's a whole bunch of billionaires out there who don't care at all and they just want to keep their own money. And buy islands and yachts and these kinds of things. What interests me about people like the Gates or Winfrey or Sheryl Sandberg or John Mackey is that they do genuinely want to get through and fix some of these problems. But their kind of story that they're telling and the kind of policies that they propose, I'm arguing that they actually don't fix these fundamental problems, and in some ways they actually exacerbate them by allowing the kind of for-profit system to evolve and kind of displace more radical critiques that would actually, in the long run, fix these kinds of problems.
Let's go through these four figures, and because I'm curious as to whether or not they are fundamentally different than others insofar as they misidentify the problem, right? I mean, let's go through it, because I want to start with John Mackey, because Mackey is, I think, of the four, in some ways, the most interesting. And certainly, like, he is, Mackey's really sort of, it seems to me, a very libertarian in his perspective. And this is sort of an ideology that seems to crop up quite a bit. And libertarian almost, genuinely libertarian on some level. Tell us who John Mackey is.
Yeah, so you're right in that sense. In that sense, Mackey is different. If we wanted to sort of think about the four figures, the five if we count, the Gates as two people, which they are, he's really different from the others in the sense that, yes, he's a staunch libertarian, whereas the others might, just sort of find themselves somewhere in the Democratic Party. And he's also really much less wealthy than the other figures, too, and he gives away a lot more of his wealth. But he's in a sense similar to them, in that he truly believes that we don't need to overhaul this kind of for-profit system. He actually is a staunch believer in this kind of idea the free markets, right?
Nicole, hold on. Let me stop you just for a second. So I don't know that most people know who John Mackey is. I mean, just in terms of like he's the CEO and the founder of Whole Foods.
Yeah, he's the CEO and founder of Whole Foods, and he's still very much at the helm of power, though there's some more power sharing going on there now. And, you know, Whole Foods is now the biggest seller of organic foods. They're, you know, buying up and building new stores at a rapacious pace. And they also, you know, Mackey himself, he recently put out a book called Conscious Capitalism, with Raj Sisodia, and it's kind of building on using Whole Foods as a store and as a model to talk about how we can actually solve the kind of environmental crisis on the horizon by just having better companies that are, you know, as he says, in tune with nature, because he's really seeing companies and free markets as kind of a natural phenomenon set apart from states, which he sees, because this fits in line with the libertarian kind of perspective. States is kind of coercive, unnatural institutions that we need to control and remove from the process, the market process, as much as possible.
I have to say that, like, literally I smile when I hear you talk about, you know, his notion of conscious capitalism and the state being unnatural. But, you know, presumably, I don't know, big box market supermarkets are natural in some way. But I mean, I find this libertarian perspective to be just sort of really stunning. Now, we should remember, like, this guy has been adamant in fighting unionism in Whole Foods. And it's and the way that he has been fighting it is by saying, like, look, my employees, and I would say probably most of the employees haven't sort of broadly speaking in Whole Foods, haven't been interested in unions, because he does treat his employees very, very well and is, you know, it seems to be concerned about sort of the ratio of CEO pay to his workers. He doesn't take any pay.
Yeah, I mean, in certain respects, the Whole Foods model. So if you look at Whole Foods employees, there's a pretty big range. I mean, actually, in Massachusetts, a lot of Whole Foods employees are actually eligible for Medicaid because they get paid pretty low wages. But definitely the employment model is better than, say, a Walmart model, for sure. He's not, you know, a kind of low-road employer. And there are a lot more kind of positive things in terms of workplace, sort of hierarchies. It's less hierarchical. Workers have a bit more agency. But certainly if we look at some of the Fight for 15 campaigns going on, we see Whole Foods workers out there. Chicago is one example. But the interesting thing about you know, thinking about the Whole Foods model, and, you know, we can look at Mackey and sort of, you know, we can definitely kind of scoff at the kind of free market model, which I unpack a bit in the book, because a lot of people really do believe in this idea of markets as being this kind of natural creation. But the interesting thing about it is that it's not just kind of libertarians who are clinging to this. If we look at kind of the mainstream environmental movement, for example, we still see very much a move towards trying to create change through companies and looking at the market as a sort of vector of change, which is interesting, right? So big environmental groups really are no longer trying to attack, you know, state institutions, whether at the national level or the institutional level. They're really just trying to get companies to act better and adopt eco practices. So in a lot of ways, they're actually kind of mirroring the kind of model that someone like Mackey is putting out there, which I think is really dangerous. And that's one of the sort of points of that chapter.
Now, I mean, this is, you know, this is the question, because we had Philip Murawski on some time ago, who was suggesting, like, that this is sort of the classic neoliberal sort of formulation, right? Neoliberalism causes a problem, it causes a crisis, and then there's a neoliberal market-based solution for every one of those crises that the last solution created. And So how is this different? I mean, is it when you see like these major environmental groups, right, who sort of are taking the same tack now, like we're going to work with these companies, and this notion that Mackey seems to have that, like, you know, if only all companies were as benevolent as or as caring or as conscious as a Whole Foods, then everything will be fine. I mean, is there a certain from the perspective of these environmental groups? Two questions: is it simply that this is the only, this is sort of the fallback position because we haven't had success in any other way, or does it create a bigger problem? I mean, I guess that's sort of the nature of the book, right? Is that these measures are letting the air out of the tires, but at the same time, they're also sort of like edifying the problem.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I think the question about why big environmental groups are doing this is a really interesting kind of thorny question. I think partly the turn to, you know, working through big corporations, we can see that as, you know, coming out of a long history of kind of failed struggle in some respect, that getting these kind of big national and federal institutions to enact the kind of laws that they want. But it also comes in a moment where we see this explosion of, you know, transnational corporations, processes that we lump under the term globalization, and really a strengthening, you know, of the kind of power of big corporations. At the same time that we see that, we also see, you know, increasing competition in the midst of this kind of increasingly resource-starved global economy. So you see firms actually becoming amenable to making these kinds of eco-business changes that, you know, groups like the Sierra Club and WWF and Greenpeace are advocating, because it's actually in their benefit to do so, to streamline their supply chains, to, you know, get better control over their smaller suppliers. It prevents lawsuits, it cuts costs, and all of these kind of things. So in many ways, their goals are kind of aligned in some ways with the goals of these environmental groups. Now, in the long run, the problem with this is that, and this is partly, I think we can think about it in terms of the problem of using the word neoliberal. We often talk about neoliberalism to refer to a particular kind of capitalism. But that can also distract us from thinking about these are problems that are fundamental to capitalism itself, not some particular period. So when we look at the inherent drives of a for-profit system that requires companies to continuously expand and compete and increase their profit margins, this is the sort of cycle that they can't break out of. So whether companies are adopting eco-business practices or not, they have to constantly be expanding and creating more profits and creating more goods. And this is something that is completely antithetical to the sort of project to not have an ecological Armageddon, right? And that's something that I think we really need to remind ourselves. If we're directing our sort of environmental movements through the firms, these firms can't, whether they're, you know, eco-business firms like Whole Foods or not, they cannot actually extract themselves from this kind of logic of accumulation. And I think this is something worth remembering.
Right. Well, let's move on to the other examples, and then we can sort of talk about sort of holistically, you know, again, and return to that notion of the importance of I guess, deconstructing these narratives, more broadly speaking, and where that leads in terms of sort of long term. Let's go to the Bill and Melinda Gates for a moment, because I had been more familiar sort of with what they had done in terms of education, and I want to talk about that. But this idea that they are trying to sort of create markets for vaccinations is really fraught with a lot of different stuff. I mean, tell us the story of their approach to these market solutions for health.
Okay, so Bill Gates and Melinda Gates, they're actually Melinda may even be more involved in the foundation than Bill is. They're both like integrally involved and have been for some time. they, again, they have another kind of capitalism that they're advocating. There's this creative capitalism as opposed to conscious capitalism. And they also are huge believers in the market. But they don't necessarily ascribe to this kind of, if we just let markets do what they wanted, they would be perfect. Instead, they say that actually capitalism does create winners and losers as something sort of the par for the course. So what their solution is, okay, they say that, you know, poor people are actually excluded from markets. So if we can just bring them into markets and sort of, you know, create markets for the things that they need, we can solve some of these problems of disease and inequality. So the vaccine example is one that's a clear example of that. So they, the Gates are saying we have all of this horrible preventable disease and childhood mortality, which is absolutely true. But the reason why we have this is because, you know, healthcare markets are not serving these poor populations. So if we can create a market, sort of create and commodify healthcare, and actually use the Gates Foundation to, you know, fund the market, right? So to pay for the vaccines to be created in the first place, and then to pay for states to actually buy those vaccines in the hopes that in the long run they could buy them themselves, we can actually serve, you know, these poor populations in a way that they wouldn't. The problem with that, there are numerous problems with the Gates, but the problem with that is not that, yes, we obviously want to prevent poor people from dying, but when, you know, when we look at sort of solving these deep problems of healthcare provision, and the solution is to create healthcare markets and to make healthcare a commodity, I think we can see that that a much better solution to that would be to create universal healthcare. And when we look at countries that have implemented universal health care, they have much better health outcomes than countries that haven't. I mean, we can just look at the United States, for example. Here, people's access to health care is really stratified by race and class in a very extreme way.
But specifically in terms of the Gates Foundation, I mean, they're looking to do this in countries where there's very little infrastructure. Is that right?
Yeah, they are. They are.
And so, I mean, the thing that I still can't even wrap my arms around, I mean, obviously there's them stepping in is somehow creating this market, right? As opposed to sort of having something that is self-sustaining. I mean, I guess is their theory that they can eliminate certain classes of disease and they'll be just gone forever and we won't need to do this again? Or, I mean, how does this, even from their perspective, how is this supposed to be sustainable? Or is it just that the Gates Foundation will keep, you know, creating these markets for vaccinations for diseases that could also be preventable by actually creating a more functioning society? I mean, what is their logic behind it? Because it seems like, okay, we can pay a drug company to develop a vaccination for, I don't know. I mean, I don't even know if there's there's got to be shots of malaria, but for certain diseases that there's no real profit margin in it for them. And then we can pay the government to buy it from the drug company so that it becomes a profit in it for them. But what happens when the Gates, you know, I don't know, go away, or whoever's running the Gates Foundation in 50 years decides like, we've done enough in that area. I'm really excited in nanotechnology or whatever it is.
Well, you know, Sam, that's a really good question. And actually, I mean, we can talk about the Gates in a minute, but we actually see some of the really devastating impacts that when you have foundations and NGOs responsible for providing life-saving drugs like HIV drugs, because many of these organizations are single issue organizations that are funded by individuals or foundations, when they lose their funding and lose their interest, people simply stop getting the drugs that they were getting. And we've seen this in places in countries in sub-Saharan Africa where people are no longer getting HIV drugs. But more specifically, if we think about the Gates, this is a great question. So part of it is there's a whole sort of economics literature about, you know, this kind of chicken or the egg. Why are countries poor? Are they poor because of, you know, economic circumstances, or are they poor because people are malnourished and unhealthy? So if maybe if we can make people healthy, they'll somehow this will lead to economic growth. I mean, there's the whole thing is a sort of convoluted argument. I think that they are thinking if we create sources of potential profit and get these kinds of international institutions like the UN and the World Health Organization on board, and we just do the legwork at the beginning, it will somehow become self-sustaining. The problem with this is that an organization like the Gates Foundation is not a democratic organization, and no one has any control over what it is that they're doing. And on top of that, they are subsidized by U.S. taxpayers, right? So all the money they write off as being, you know, and they're not alone in this, other foundations too, as sort of charitable giving doesn't go into sort of the public pot that can be democratically decided on how to use this money. Because they have so much money, they really can, you know, completely change the terms of the debate. So they don't support universal health care, for example. And because they have so much wealth and influence, they can really kind of shape how people are talking about healthcare provision. And I think this is something, you know, that we really should be talking about more.
Well, so okay, so I mean, I'm trying to parse this because there seems to be two different, like multiple different problems with what they're doing. I mean, one is that we just mentioned that, well, they can just turn around and walk away at one point. And it also sort of ironically, it seems to me that every sort of criticism you hear, and it seems to me like the John Mackey version of the way things work and the Bill and Melinda Gates version is almost sort of like the von Mises and Hayek split in some way, where one is sort of like pure market and the other one's like, well, we've got to make sure that the market works in the way that we want it to work on some level. But the problem with the Bill and Melinda Gates thing in terms of the vaccinations is, I guess the closest example I could give was, I remember Naomi Klein coming back from Davos one year, and there was a, I can't remember, Sharon Stone got up in front of a room full of people where a bunch of NGOs were looking for some deep infrastructure investment from a bunch of billionaires and said, all we need are 100,000 nets to protect kids from mosquito bites, and we can end malaria there. And all these billionaires said, like, oh, yeah, sure. If it's only going to cost me $100,000 per person, I'll do that. And, well, at one point, the nets fall apart. And at one point, you know, the nets break. What happens then? This is, in other words, this doesn't seem to be a sustainable solution. If they walk away at one point, the whole thing falls apart, which is one of the problems. But the other problem is just sort of the broader problem in that they are still promoting a system that led people to this situation in the first place.
Yeah. Precisely. I mean, you said it very well. I mean, the reasons why we have these really horrible health disparities, you know, particularly we have them both within countries. You see it in rich countries like the United States, but also between countries, the global north and the global south. These are sort of deep economic, political, social reasons that can't be solved with bed nets and vaccines. But people do have ideas for how to solve them, right? We have experts in public health who talk about, you know, introducing systems of universal health care provision along with nutritional programs and various things that really can not just eliminate particular diseases, but improve health overall to see better health outcomes and decrease mortality. These programs are definitely out there, but they get silenced and underfunded when you have a group who, like the Gates, who really deeply believe in drawing more and more aspects of our lives into the market, and that will be the way to eliminate these kind of disparities. And as exactly as you said, this doesn't do that. It might sort of put a Band-Aid on it in particular places at particular points in time, not to say even down the road, but it completely leaves in place these sort of fundamental drives of, you know, markets create inequality. And when your ability to access something is always dependent upon your ability to pay for it, rather than saying, why don't we just view healthcare as a right, right, that everyone should have, rather than that, which now is, you know, seems like a utopian kind of vision, but it's not that crazy. Then you see just, not only do you see a reproduction of the system as it is, but it also, you know, burnishes this kind of facade of like capitalism can provide these kinds of positive outcomes, which it really can't. I mean, if we look at kind of increasing inequality, both, you know, globally and in the United States, I think it really does call into question the ability of markets to solve these really deep questions.
You know, I mean, it's interesting because I think like this example is the best example, it seems to me, in the book of sort of the dilemma here and also where you're headed with this is that one, obviously it's good that poor kids are going to be inoculated and vaccinated against the diseases. It's going to save lives. But it's important to understand, I think, and this is what I think your book is communicating, that by the act of them commodifying, but their actions by commodifying healthcare, they are perpetuating a system that will always leave future generations in need of a benevolent billionaire.
Exactly. And you know, if we took the money that goes into the Gates Foundation, right, which is much of it is subsidized by U.S. taxpayers, and actually used that for projects to promote universal healthcare, we could see a totally different outcome, right? I mean, their budget is bigger than the World Health Organization. We should have these sort of democratic institutions. This is where the funding should be flowing through to create, you know, to create solutions, not through, you know, an organization that's literally only answerable to Bill and Melinda Gates, right? Maybe they have really good ideas, but maybe they have really terrible ideas, which they have a number of those as well.
Well, that, I mean, that
say over what they're doing.
I just want to briefly touch on education because I think that is sort of the problem in their involvement in education. They are of the ilk that believes that education is the solution to poverty rather than poverty being the problem with education in this country. And they come in and they have such just raw power because of their financing that we get a whole system of education reform, in quotes, in this country that is that has really, I think, been very problematic, where, again, it's a sort of this data-driven education, which is really sort of antithetical, I think, to sort of what the purpose of education is. And it's limiting education as a function in society.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if I touch on education a bit, and actually Megan Erickson, who's another editor at Jacobin, she's going to have a book coming out on education, and she wrote a really good article in the last issue, the technology issue on education, that talks about some of these ideas too, so people should check out her stuff. But yeah, the Gates in education are just, they're kind of scary. And again, they're really not alone. They're part of this whole kind of education reform movement, which, and the logic is exactly the same as the global healthcare stuff. Basically saying, isn't it weird that education isn't governed by markets, public education that is? Don't we think that schools should be run like businesses and teachers should be held to the same standard as, you know, engineers or you know, small business owners, and I think that this is interesting in the sense that there are so many business people who get on board with educational reform, but also, you know, when you talk to, there's such a sort of disconnect between how people feel about their own schools, where their children go, and the kind of national debate about education being in crisis, that you really see the power of foundations like the Gates to sort of create this whole panic about public education, where it really doesn't exist. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't, you know, try to fix the problems of public education. There are some serious problems. But to make this kind of blanket statement, and Diane Ravitch really talks about this most eloquently, you know, that public education is broken, it's kind of terrifying. It's not only wrong, but they're trying to basically, you know, take what is one of, you know, the most fundamental public goods that we have in the United States and, you know, transform it into a market-led domain.
Well, it's always easiest. I mean, this is that formula of this thing is broken, therefore we should basically reform it out of existence on some level is, I mean, we see that with Social Security. That's always been the plan. Social Security is fundamentally broken. That's why we need to privatize it and essentially make it go away. All right, well, let's jump to Oprah because your analysis of Oprah reminds me a little bit of we spoke to, I think it was Helen Olane, or she wrote a book about the sort of personal finance industry and like the Dave Ramseys and the I can't remember the name of the other one, but basically Oprah is very sort of similar in sort of saying like it's all ahead of you if you're willing to make the sacrifices necessary to succeed, you can succeed, right? I mean, that's the give us the Oprah take.
Yeah, so Oprah's a very interesting person. She really is she embodies the American dream really in a kind of rags to riches story to the extreme. She's interesting. So if we think about the sort of problems that I address in the book, so the Mackey chapter is kind of about environmentalism and the Gates chapter is kind of about sort of global inequality and education and poverty. Oprah is really about sort of unhappiness, anxiety, stress, uncertainty, and this kind of desire for self-actualization. So that's really, if we think about the kind of problems that she's addressing, that's kind of what her whole kind of, why her stories are so appealing. You know, we think about, I teach undergraduate students, you know, undergraduate students are incredibly stressed out and uncertain about the future. They don't feel like they're going to get a job. They don't feel like there's, you know, going to be a place for them in the world. And we look at sort of the older kind of baby boomers who got laid off during the Great Recession and their difficulties in actually just getting rehired. You know, we have this kind of pervasive sense of stress and anxiety. And someone like Oprah, and she's really not alone, you know, in telling her story, she's really telling people that, you know, you just need to adapt yourself, right? And improve your own self. Get more, get more skills, meet more people, network, market yourself, this kind of thing, and be thankful for adversity, right? Because it allows you to, see where you should be going with. This kind of idea that you can really think yourself out of your problems and locate, you know, the root and the solution of society's problems within the self. That's really the core of her message. And you see it not just from Oprah, right? She is sort of the popularizer of it, particularly starting in the 90s. But you see it everywhere. So in the chapter, I also talk about the Freelancers Union, for example, which is basically looking at all of this contingent work that soon might even dominate the way we work, and saying, you know, here are all the individual ways that, you know, you freelancers can adapt to make it in the world. And it's really unfair because people aren't going to make it just by, you know, fixing themselves.
Right. I mean, it's basically telling people that there's no broader societal solution. We shouldn't look to government and really the power of the commons is irrelevant to this whole thing. And in some way, you talk about Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In. And I've not read her book, but in some way that's consistent. That's similar, it seems to me, with Sandberg's message in the context of feminism.
Yeah, I think so, for sure. And I just want to say, if people are interested in Oprah more, they should definitely check out Janice Peck. She wrote an amazing book about Oprah called The Age of Oprah, where she's basically looking at neoliberalism and its similarities to the Gilded Age and the kind of ideas that are prominent then and the ideas that are prominent now. But I agree, yeah, Sandberg is really similar in that respect. You know, she's a feminist. She believes in the feminist project, and she's she's putting out a kind of manifesto, as she says it, for women to actually sort of get ahead in the workplace and take power, with the idea that if we have more women in power, we'll be able to sort of solve these kind of deep and persistent gender divides that we see, not only in the U.S., but globally. And there's a lot of people actually calling for this now. Hillary Clinton, of course, is one of the sort of, you know, key points of her appeal and, you know, kind of pitch, right, to get people to vote for her. Like, we need a woman in power to sort of solve the problems of not just the United States, but, you know, sort of the global economy kind of thing. So, yeah, in that sense, it's definitely similar.
And it's also her advice in terms of the workplace, right, is don't change the workplace per se, right? Change yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think she thinks that maybe, so there's a weird kind of part to this, which is not super explicit, but a lot of this kind of, you know, putting women in power, and if we have women in power, they'll make the lives of other women better. It's kind of contingent on this idea that women are different from men. Like, maybe we're inherently different, or we're socialized to be different so that we'll look out for each other, whereas, you know, men don't. This in itself is a bit problematic, certainly if we look at, you know, Margaret Thatcher as a kind of classic example. Having women in power doesn't necessarily achieve the goals of feminism. But there is a deeper kind of problem with her message, in that it's linking the goals of feminism and mapping them one-to-one onto the goals of companies, right? Saying, you can achieve what you want in life by working really hard for the company that you're in, and you know, putting all of your creativity and energy into this place, which, you know, will then achieve the goals that you want. I think that's partly why we see Fortune 500 companies like Walmart, for example, which has, you know, recently been sued for discrimination against women, lining right up behind this lean in message, because it fits, it's perfect for them. You know, if we have all of these creative women who are really beset by this problem of managing their work and home life, which is a real problem, if you have all of these women just saying, nope, I'm going to dump all of my energies into, you know, making my company great, well, this is perfect, right? Because not only is it good for these companies, but it burnishes this kind of meritocratic facade, right? That they can, that they care about gender inequality and they really want to, you know, support the causes of feminism, which I don't think is actually true.
Right. And it promotes that idea that sort of the meritocracy exists in nature, too, right? That's not a social construct. It's sort of just the meritocracy stands right alongside the market, and they both just grew up in a cabbage patch somewhere.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, and so it really gets down to sort of, you know, how you're defining the feminist project. Is it just about equal opportunity, or is it really about, equality and justice and sort of making people's lives better, whether they're men or women? And so, you know, at an individual level, I think for certain women, they could really benefit from Sandberg's message. And I think her one of her core messages is that women do need to stop worrying about being a perfect mother, daughter, wife, etc. That is true, and I think we should definitely, I'm on board with that. But this idea that we can achieve the goals of feminism, I think a few women, it will work for them, but there is not place in the system or the structure for all of these women to use this model to make their lives better. That's just fundamentally false. The ways that most women are going to improve their lives is by organizing together, collectively, through unions or other types of organizations to demand better maternity care or paid maternity leave or sick pay or higher wages or all of these kinds of things. This is how it's going to happen, not through this kind of individual by individual strategy of taking power. That's not how it's going to work.
So lastly, what is it that you want people to take away, broadly speaking, from the book?
I mainly want people to think about, you know, some of the kind of fundamental features of the society that we live in, and some of the fundamental drives that come from it. Not as a kind of, you know, these are the rules that determine everything we do, but to think about, you know, when people are talking about markets, right, or commodities, to think about how, you know, our lives fit with the kind of for-profit system. So if we want our lives to be better, right, I think one of the things I want people to take away is this idea that we have to remove them from the logic of always trying to, the need to create a profit, right? So when we're thinking about things like, you know, making our lives better, whether by improving education or healthcare or having a roof over our head or not working so hard, it's about taking back and developing projects that take back those fears from being ruled by the market. One of the things I wanted people to be wary of when they're reading the stories of someone like, you know, John Mackey or the Gates, who really are saying a lot of the things that we agree with, is to just keep in mind that the stories that they are telling are really strengthening these kinds of structures that create the problems in the first place. And so at the end of the book, which is kind of short, I just kind of talk about, you know, the things that we need to be demanding in order to really make our lives better. So you brought up the example of Social Security earlier. I think that's a really good example. It's constantly under attack, but it's really, you know, it's been a lot harder for people to get rid of Social Security than it has, for example, to get rid of welfare rights, right? And one of the reasons why is because it's something that benefits everyone, right? It's not means tested. It's something that we consider almost a right, and it's something that we expect, right? And I think that this idea of turning things back into rights rather than things that are mediated by our ability to pay or not pay for them is really fundamental to solving some of the problems that we have.
Nicole Aschoff, a lecturer at BU, editor at Jacobin, and author of New Profits of Capital. Thanks so much for your time today. We will link to the book at majority.fm.
Thanks, Sam. Have a good one.
You too. All right, folks. Just a reminder. This show exists because of your support. Tomorrow, we're going to be, hopefully, starting a month where we're going to be offering a Credo phone deal. We've done this, I think, like this will be the third year out of four, I think, that we've done it, or maybe third out of third. So we'll have 1 month of a sponsor of the program, but still we're hovering around 98.7% of our revenue. Comes from our members. So if you have the financial means to become a member, please join today at majority.fm. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, if you're already doing that, then buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. And if you drink coffee, by all means, you got to try out justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. They're in Madison, Wisconsin. It's sort of a theme today. Russ Feingold's running. I don't know how to tie that in. He's not in any way affiliated with Just Coffee, but nevertheless, Fair Trade Coffee, employee owned company. It's a co-op, thus .coop, COOP, and use the coupon code Majority, get 10% off. They have free shipping now. So wonderful coffee. Free shipping. I can't even express how many wins that is for everybody. And I want to thank those of you who gave us new iTunes reviews. It made my day yesterday by heading over to iTunes and just giving us a review. Also, if you want the app, pick it up at majorityapp.com, iOS or Android. It is it's totally free. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of the program. Also, of course, you can IM me. We'll be right back.